Beginning with North Korea just a year ago, China last month, Japan this past Sunday, and now South Korea just yesterday, there's new leadership in Northeast Asia, vitally important as it includes three of the world's major economies, a brutal dictatorship armed with nuclear weapons, and more than a few potential flashpoints. Scott Snyder joins us now from a studio at the Council on Foreign Relations here in Washington, where he's a senior fellow for Korea Studies and director of the Program for U.S.-Korea Policy. Good to have you with us today.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And let's begin in Seoul. An historic election yesterday of its first female president.
That's right. South Korea has its first woman president, Park Geun-hye. She's well known to Koreans because she is the daughter of the former president, authoritarian leader Park Chung-hee. And she is, I think, set to deal with some very difficult challenges emerging in South Korea's neighborhood.
And she is her party, center-right, thought to be pretty similar to her predecessor. That's not quite the case in Japan, where Shinzo Abe's second term as prime minister, he's considerably to the right of his predecessor.
It's interesting. In Japan, it's the same prime minister that was in place 6 years ago, but the political environment, I think, has shifted in some dramatic ways. And so I think one of the interesting aspects of the Japanese situation is that the LDP has returned to power, the Liberal Democratic Party has returned to power, but now they have a party that is to the right of them.
And so we talk about those two states and, of course, the other major player, the biggest in the region, China, where Xi Jinping took command just last month formally.
That's right. And I think we're still waiting to see how China's foreign policy priorities are really going to develop under Xi. The process seems to be moving slowly, and it's not necessarily terribly transparent at this point. We know there are new top leaders in the room, but it's just not clear exactly how they're making decisions or whether they're going to change much in terms of China's overall priorities.
And if transparency is a problem in Beijing, it's positively, murky is too easy a word for what's going on in Pyongyang.
It's absolutely true that one of the most complicated and interesting questions is what we don't know about the North Korean leadership situation. They control, generally speaking, what we see. We know that there have been significant changes within the top military leadership. It appears to be part of a consolidation process under this new leader, Kim Jong-un, but you can't discount the possibility that there could be backlash.
And let me ask about some of the things that we know some of this new leadership has done thus far. And we'll begin with North Korea, where Kim Jong-un has been in power this past year since his father passed away. He's the third of his family, that dynasty, to rule in North Korea. And there was finally success, I guess mixed success, but mostly success in the launch of a missile that put a satellite into orbit. Of course, a missile is also could be an intercontinental ballistic missile. What does that portend about North Korea, and what does it say about the region?
Well, so far it suggests that North Korea is going to continue to be the number one security challenge for an increasingly divided region, and in fact that the North Korean security challenge could be becoming more difficult, both as a matter of trying to deal with North Korea and as an issue that requires cooperation among all of the countries in Northeast Asia in order to be able to have a hope of managing it in any stable way.
North Korea is also a moral challenge for the new leader in South Korea.
There's a sovereignty aspect to that longstanding confrontation. Both sides have been pitted against each other for a long time. The new leader, Park Geun-hye, has made it clear, has been quite explicit, actually, about naming human rights as an issue that would have to be dealt with in North Korea. But she's also reaching out a hand and is likely to offer opportunities for dialogue with North Korea as a way of stabilizing the inter-Korean security relationship.
Stabilizing that relationship means, of course, leaving all those millions of people in North Korea in, dire conditions.
That's true in the sense that Park is not pursuing the alternative of total confrontation. At the same time, you know, the one thing that I think seems to be clear up to now is that none of the countries have been willing to risk that sort of military confrontation in order to drive external change in North Korea.
Has China, the most influential outside force in North Korea, has China handled the new leader more warmly or more distantly than his father?
Well, the Chinese leadership has continued to seek dialogue first with Kim Jong-un. They've had two publicly announced meetings with him. One of them came right in advance of North Korea's announcement that it was going to pursue a satellite launch. We don't know whether that subject was discussed in China, but, you know, the indicators suggest that China is still trying to figure out if there's a way that it can influence the situation in North Korea without taking measures that would enhance instability. The Chinese priority is basically to maintain stability in North Korea.
So it's willing to prop up that terrible regime if it will prevent that regime's collapse and the horrible situation that might ensue.
I think it's certainly the case that if you're looking at why North Korea still is there in the middle of this otherwise prosperous region, the hand of China is the critical explainer for why North Korea is still able to survive.
Xi Jinping has been in power just a brief time in Beijing, but in that time we have seen increased pressure on the Senkaku Islands. These are the disputed islands, unoccupied, uninhabited islands in the East China Sea. Japan has controlled them for, 100 years? China claims them as well. There have been confrontations in the past where patrol boats and fishing boats had exchanged even water cannon spray. But this time a Chinese patrol craft flew over the islands, and that's a different situation.
That's right. I think the Senkakus is rising as one of the issues of greatest concern as we look at East Asian security. It's really related to, I think, the Chinese enhanced effort to try to establish some form of claim to administrative control over a feature that they claim ownership of, but the Japanese really are the ones who have administrative control over the island at this point.
And has the United States said this is Japanese territory or this is Chinese territory?
Well, the United States does not take a position on the sovereignty claim, but it is committed to the defense of territories that are under Japan's administrative control.
And this has been an issue of great nationalist fervor in both Japan and China.
Yes, the islands have become a symbol where the dual nationalisms are coming into direct confrontation with each other.
And as you mentioned, there is a party now to the right of the LDP in Japan, and they make it even more of an issue.
That's right. Really, this whole situation with the Senkakus, I think, began to take on a more serious coloring as a result of the former Tokyo mayor Ishihara's expression of a desire to occupy or purchase the island from the former owners, and then subsequently the Japanese government took ownership of the island.
To prevent an even more provocative situation, but that was provocative enough for the Chinese.
It did constitute a change to the status quo that had prevailed for the previous three decades, and I think one of the results has been that there's been this increase in tensions and occasional conflict between China and Japan.
And there was also that when that Chinese patrol craft flew over, a couple of weeks ago, the then government of Japan was embarrassed because they didn't notice it until it was too late.
It's a very serious escalatory step because there's also a greater risk in terms of potential for accident or other unplanned escalation of the conflict.
Yeah, as we saw with the American patrol plane went over Hainan Island all those many years ago, back in 2000, I guess.
That's right, 2001, I think.
As you look at these new leadership, are we going to see something different? I mean, there are always vows of the party out of power, the LDP in Japan, for example, coming back into power, vowing to reinvigorate the Japanese economy. Do they have a prospect for that? Do they have a plan for that? Is that something that the Japanese people will come to expect, or is there likely to be grave disappointment in a couple of years with them as there was with their predecessors?
Well, in the case of Japan, I think that it might be seen as an advancement if the prime minister can simply hold his seat for over a year. We've seen a revolving leadership there for the past 7 years, where the change in prime ministers, I think, has actually been a contributing factor to the inability, perhaps, to find effective policies. You know, one other aspect of this I think is interesting is that with all of these leadership changes, people thought perhaps that the deck in Northeast Asia was going to be reshuffled somehow. And yet, ironically, it seems that we see more continuity than we do change, and we see more focus on the issues of the past or historical issues than we do opportunities for changing the paradigm in the future.
Scott Snyder is the Senior Fellow for Korea Studies and the Director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And you mentioned that parade of prime ministers in Tokyo. Mr. Abe himself was a short-term prime minister as he got himself into some trouble on nationalist, among other issues. Is he likely to trim his sails back towards the center this time? He ran a pretty nationalist campaign.
Well, those specialists who have had direct contact with him suggests that he's really a realist and a pragmatist, and that, in fact, last time when he was prime minister, he did curb some of those rhetorical impulses and, in fact, opened up a kind of a new page in the relationship between Japan and China. Certainly, that sort of statesmanship is in great demand at this stage, given the increasing tensions in the regional environment.
And the as his rule may be ephemeral, we will have to see. China, the new leaders there can look forward to a decade, if history, recent history is any guide. I guess we've seen two now transitions of power in China that were reasonably predictable. But as they look ahead, does that suggest caution? Does that suggest, what signs are you looking for? What indicators as to what they will do on the crucial issue, for example, of political reform?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the complex aspect of the Chinese leadership transition is that Xi Jinping was elevated along with a group of six other men who, with the exception of the prime minister, are likely to be gone in 5 years. And so, you know, that it's hard to read the tea leaves, but it suggests that that this is really a set of half measures. That it's unlikely that she would necessarily be very bold in the first 5 years at a time when China arguably is facing increasing internal social and political pressures.
Expectations of a burgeoning middle class, that's one thing. On the other hand, though billions have been, many millions have been lifted out of poverty, many millions remain.
Well, many millions have been lifted out of poverty, and many millions seem to have been lifted into the pockets of the top leaders. And so that, I think, reporting of socioeconomic inequity and privilege is a source of corruption in the Communist Party that really has to be managed or dealt with in some decisive form by President Xi.
And is there going to be realignment? And you look towards the new leadership in South Korea. The United States, of course, has had a long-standing security relationship with South Korea, going back to the war there in the early 1950s. And of course, you mentioned the treaty with Japan. The United States been had bases there since 1945. Is there going to be any fundamental change in those relationships, do you think?
The change is not coming so much in the U.S.-Japan or in the U.S.-Korea alliance relationships at this stage. There are some rising tensions that have emerged in the South Korea-Japan relationship that present, I think, a challenge for U.S. policymakers. You know, one of the aspects of the U.S. pivot or rebalancing policy is that it suggests that we want allies to work together horizontally with each other more actively. But Korea and Japan are increasingly facing divisions over history issues. And with a woman South Korean president and a Japanese prime minister who has raised questions about some of the comfort women issues, it suggests that we've got potentially a rocky road ahead.
Comfort women, the Korean women who were drafted, I guess is too easy a word, sex slaves for Japanese occupation troops in Korea for many years.
That's correct.
And the Japanese declined to acknowledge this at times, and it has been Mr. Abe from time to time who has declined to acknowledge Japanese war crimes during the Second World War.
Well, there's an active political debate in Japan over the question of whether the existing statements by Japan on this issue are going to stand up. And so a step toward or a step away from acknowledging some of these past historical issues would be actually a big setback, I think, for Japan in the region.
Scott Snyder, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll look forward to seeing how this new leadership changes things.
Thanks for the chance to be here.
Scott Snyder, Senior Fellow for Korea Studies and Director of the Program for U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Tomorrow, Talk of the Nation Science Friday with the annual Christmas Bird Count, and John Donvan will be here with you on Monday. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Have a happy holiday, everybody. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.